Well, kicking off this hour, insubordination. It's the act of willfully disobeying a lawful order of one's superior. It's generally an act that's looked down upon, considered disrespectful, or simply wrong. A new book challenges our assumptions and offers a step-by-step guide to social change through challenging the status quo. Psychologist Todd Kashdan is the author of the new book, The Art of Insubordination, How to Dissent and Defy Effectively. And he joins us live on Culture Shift. Good afternoon, Todd.
Hey, so nice to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for making the time to talk on the show today. So let's to kick it off with that word itself, insubordination. It's a term that doesn't often come up in many people's day-to-day lives unless they're part of a strict organization like, for instance, the military. Could you give us a refresher on what defines insubordination and why you chose to explore this concept for your new book?
Yeah, it was deliberately chosen as a provocative word that's deemed a negative that's actually a positive. And it's really about any time you view authority figures or rules or orders or social norms that you find to be dysfunctional and you refuse, that's an act of insubordination. And what I'm interested in and have been studying of the 60 years of research on this is principled insubordination, where you realize that you are willing to sacrifice your short-term well-being and risk being having scorn or negative valuation because there's something that's the people are moving towards that isn't working, right? The Dr. Phil question of, is that working for you? Dysfunctional ideas and dysfunctional practices. And you're seeing a lot of this in the society, and some of it's principled and a lot more of it is unprincipled, of challenging the mainstream and things you know that are absurd, and you're willing to speak out and wondering, why is nobody else saying what I'm saying?
So why was this the right time for this kind of book for you?
Well, I started this 6 years ago. So this is before Trump, before COVID. Social media still existed. It was around the time of the Arab Springs, where you had, you know, still the allure of the social media experiment is amazing. You have these people under the tyranny of Tunisia and Libya, and they're able to find other liberators and reach Western soil and get troops in and get military action to actually overthrow leaders that were, you know, oppressing women and oppressing men and oppressing people's ability to live lives in the way that they want to. And that trend and the trend of the promotion of diversity, but at the same time, There's two forms of diversity that we've allowed to fall through the cracks. And one is ageism and one is intellectual conformity, that we really want people to think what we believe are the right thoughts. And in some way, as people are increasing their desire for diversity, they're doing what most leaders do as they gain power, is oppressing people who have diverse views.
All right, so you write about how often acts of insubordination, whether that is against long-held ideas like how life on Earth began or changing the culture of an organization, how it's difficult to affect change because of all of our ingrained hesitancy. It's built into our structures, it's built into our organizations, and it's also kind of built into us, our hesitancy to either rock the boat or all of the numerous cognitive biases that we have against new information, against change itself. So what specifically are some of those obstacles, those cognitive biases you write about?
I mean, here's the two big ones that pop into the mind of someone that's about to raise their hand in a work meeting or about to tell their neighbors of, you know what, I don't like that racist joke that you just had at the Super Bowl party. The two thoughts that pop in is, one, why is nobody else speaking up against this? And I must be wrong, because there's a lot of intelligent, wise people that I respect around me. So you have this sense of self-doubt that creeps into your inner voice. And the second one is, do I want to bring more friction and stress into my life, knowing that someone's going to probably disagree with me, and I don't know who my friends are going to be, my allies are going to be for this cause, because life is pretty stressful as it is. You know, we've got mortgages, we've got grout, we've got, you know, we have bills to pay, mouths to feed, And so it makes sense that we choose conformity, cohesion, harmony, positivity, because all of those things are seemingly good. And one of the interesting things, what I call the dissenter's paradox, is what's bad for the individual who wants to disagree with social norms is great for the group because it helps it evolve and become more creative and innovative in the future.
So for somebody wanting to, I guess, take that step to stand up for them, what is right, and they're facing all of these challenges, personal challenges, like perhaps they might get fired, perhaps, their spouse might leave them or something. So for someone taking that step, what is the number one first step in, you know, if you really believe in what you want and what you're saying and that you can, you know, have an idea that can make things better, what's that first step in making it a reality on a ground level basis?
I'm so glad you phrased it that way. The first step always is there's this test that the audience is going to give anyone that's going to say something against the grain. And the test is, are you one of us? Are you an insider? And a lot of people failed this test. A lot of potential senators and congressmen and women who are going around to try to win an election, they go into different towns and counties and they try to show that, hey, I'm one of you. You know, they go to a local circus and they're eating, you know, fried dough or fried Twinkies, and they're kind of eating whatever the local food fair is, talking the local dialect, mentioning the local teams. But all it needs is the audience to ask a question. Someone pops into New York and wants to be the governor, like Andrew Yang tried to do. And they asked him questions of, hey, where's your favorite place to go for pizza? Hey, are you a Yankee fan or a Met fan? And then they followed up with more questions. And it was very clear of, this guy isn't one of us. Like, he's not really a New Yorker. Like, what is he doing trying to lead our group? And that cost him a sufficient amount of goodwill on the audience part to hear his message and actually critically evaluate, do you have good ideas? So first is that group insider test. And the second test, if you pass that one, is your message going to be more of a threat than more of a curiosity and a value add to our world? And people here have to be very careful about, can you clarify the message to say, listen, I know exactly why you want to have these ethanol subsidies. Let's say that you're in Iowa and it's valuable to you and it helps the community. I'm interested in you being self-sufficient away from the government, and I want to invest in community colleges, in trade schools, in technology, in education, because the government might change and you never know when they're going to take away those subsidies. So you're basically explaining, I know this is good for you, but I'm going to create something that's even better for you. So you have to really be audience-centric when you're a dissenter.
We're talking to author Todd Kashtan. He has written a new book called The Art of Insubordination, How to Dissent and Defy Effectively. Todd, you also write in the book a lot of personal experiences that you have, kind of being the person in the organization who says, hey, wait, this isn't right. Let's do things a little bit differently here. Can you talk about some of the personal stories you have of this act and how you took these strategies and applied them to your own life?
Yeah, I'll mention stuff that's not even in the book. I mean, the last president of George Mason University, he put me on the university-wide well-being and diversity committee. And I was, one of the only, white men on this committee. And the first thing they did was bring up the definition of diversity. And I just raised my hand, knowing that, my heart's racing an extra 10 beats per minute. My hands are a little bit sweaty because I know this is not the question I'm supposed to be asking, which is, hey, I noticed that social class isn't in the definition. And neurodiversity isn't in the definition of diversity, right? People that are on the autism spectrum, people that have ADHD. And I noticed, thinking about Susan Cain's book, Quiet, of people that are introverted who are quieter and take more time to process information. They're often discriminated against, especially in educational environments, that they're not included in the diversity. Why is that the case? And you could hear even from my inflection, it comes from a place of curiosity, not to say you have the definition wrong. I, as the white heterosexual man, has the definition right. And this is really an important point about being a dissenter. You have to be willing to be intellectually humble and curious and lead with those psychological strengths. Now, what happened in that situation, the room was dead silence. Nobody responded to me. Nobody looked at me. And they moved on as if I didn't even speak. But here's the important part about being a dissenter and where it's a really important lesson from science. What makes a dissenter effective, the number one variable is consistency over time. The evidence shows that those parts, those individual differences belong in a definition of diversity. So I stick with it. I can provide the science. I can provide objective data that shows that teachers are less likely to call on those groups and they're less likely to respect and dignify those groups. And the other one is I know that I'm not going to change people's minds right then and there, but I kind of got a little earworm that it went into everyone's brain so that when they leave, they're going to have to think a little bit about, should we think more broadly about diversity? And that's all you could ask for. And just as an addendum, I might not get credit if they change the definition. And you have to be willing to not see your name as one of the authors or one of the people appreciated, because the goal is the larger aim of helping those kids that are going to be in that classroom, helping those workers in the future who are diverse and underappreciated. And it's not about ego.
You also write about how difficult it can be to change an organization's structure or to change the status quo in general. And it not just difficult to get people on your side, but because people sometimes, you write about within the organization or within that structure itself, are really against any kind of change, even if that change has the possibility of benefiting them. Why is that?
So there's two psychological needs that every person in a group is trying to satisfy, and we forget one of them. And there's a balance between these two. One is the need to belong. We want to fit in. Two is the need for uniqueness. We want to show that we're not expendable and we stand out. Now, they're somewhat contradictory to each other. And too often groups lean on belonging, fitting in. You have a home. We created a home for people that are like us that happens here. And when you do that, everyone starts to suppress and self-silence what they truly believe if it's counter to what they think the group cares about and values. Great for cohesion and for people nodding their heads and laughing at the same time. Bad for the evolution of a group to be actually functional and helpful towards their mission. You need people that are willing to disagree to make your arguments better, to make your mission better, and to make sure that your strategies are not outdated. And this is why a lot of social movements fail. You know, look at Occupy Wall Street, the greatest example of so many people interested, but they didn't clarify the tactics, the strategies, or how they're going to mobilize towards the end game of decreasing, you know, wealth inequity and opportunity hoarding. And it fizzled out because they didn't really have a way to actually bring people on board because the message wasn't clear. And what do you do with people who have more resources than you? What do you do with the enemies, the foes that you've labeled here? They had no plan for them and they weren't going anywhere and it fizzled out.
We're talking to author and psychologist Todd Kashtan about his new book, The Art of Insubordination, How to Dissent and Defy Effectively. Todd, I guess just wrapping up here, you've created, you know, this book. It is a step-by-step guide, a practical guide, you say, to creating these kind of big changes, what you call principled rebellion. So just as we wrap up, what are three of the main points that you want people reading it to take away?
Well, one is we spend a lot of time on changing behaviors that we can see, but we know from science that changing social norms, we can't see them. They're abstract. They're more powerful. So you have to think about your group. Can you let people know that we don't value people having unanimous views? We don't value homogeneous thinking. We value critical thinking. We value autonomy, and we're going to treat disagreement as a sign of love and loyalty, not as a sign of disrespect. And you have to clarify that every time groups meet. And by doing that, you increase people's willingness to be creative, to be original, and you're more likely to kind of be innovative as a group.
All right. Thank you so much, Todd. Pat Cashton is the author of the book, The Art of Insubordination, How to Effectively Dissent and Defy